Welcome to Condensed History Gems with me, Greg Chapman.
And me, Jem Deducci.
And Jem, today we are going to do one of the most appalling things, one of the things that, you know, always seems to be a struggle. Because today we are going to be looking at the history of comedy.
And oh, no, we're not.
Well, the big problem that I have with looking at the history of comedy is kind of the same problem that I have with books about comedy and everything else. You know, I've studied comedy, I've studied particularly physical comedy. And the thing is, the more you examine comedy, the more you study it, the more you look into the history of comedy, I'll be honest, the more boring things tend to become. you think we're going to talk about comedy this week, this will be a light-hearted, we'll just be joke, 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 joke. And what you actually kind of end up doing is basically being a little bit boring, because you suddenly start getting all academic and pontificating about comedy and everything else. So, do you have, just out of interest, do you have a particular area you want to start in with the history of comedy?
Well, Greg, I thought I'd start with the world's oldest surviving joke.
Okay, if you're going to do the world's oldest surviving joke, am I going to have to be a little bit careful with the rating on this podcast? Because as I recall, if we both got the same joke, the world's oldest joke does involve just a little tiny bit of toilet humour. Am I quite correct?
Well, I don't think it's anything inappropriate. I mean, yeah, so the world's oldest joke, if people don't know, it's, I'm pretty sure most people don't know, but it's from the sort of like the ancient Babylonian, ancient Sumerian. It's nearly 4,000 years old, and it's simply this.
Wait. I don't want simply this, Jim. Okay, here's a scene. We are ancient Babylonian. We're back in the past. You are the, it's 1900 years BC. It's about 4,000 years ago. You are this young, I believe it's Sumerian. You are this young Sumerian stand-up comic. You come out onto the stage. You walk up to your, well, obviously not a microphone, but you walk up to the stage. You've got the tribe of adoring fans surrounding you, and you deliver the joke that's going to last and echo down the ages.
I say. No. Something which has never occurred since time immemorial. A young woman did not fart in her husband's lap. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. I'm here all week. But what is interesting, what I find interesting about that, well, first of all, I do find it interesting how much comedy ages. You know, you can see a movie from the 1970s. I mean, recently I've watched with my wife The Godfather and The Godfather Part 2. And oh my God, they are amazing films. And you can see how influential they've been to cinema since then. But these films are 40 years old. You watch comedy from the early 1970s, they ain't funny. I mean, occasionally there might be the odd laugh. People say, oh, Some Like It Hot, that's a, you know, a classic film. And that is still funny. But loads of comedy does not age well. And what I find interesting about this is, yes, it's not particularly funny, but it's toilet humour. It's a fart joke. And, you know, I think that, you know, even little children find bottoms and poo and farting inherently funny, because it's kind of involuntary, it's uncivilized, it's naughty in the nicest, most innocent sense of the word. And I love the fact, and if you like, so this is where I am going to get heavy for a moment. An awful lot of the time when you're looking at history, you're looking at death, you're looking at kings, you're looking at politics, you're looking at social history, and it's almost like the past had no sense of humour whatsoever. So I think it's wonderful that we can go back to, you know, nearly 4,000 years and find out people found farts just as funny then as they do today.
I think that's true. And what I found really interesting, because I assume that when you found that joke, you found the same study that I did, trying to find the oldest joke. And I remember seeing it before. And what I found quite interesting about it as well, because you talk about it being, you know, that level of humour. Well, the second oldest joke that they kind of discovered in that was about was a joke from 1600 years BC made about a pharaoh.
I am aware of that one. Yes.
Shall I have a go now? Let's see if I can raise the roof.
I've got Sumerian comedy locked down. It's over to you, Greg, to bring to life ancient Egypt.
Okay, here we go. I shall. No, we're not doing that, are we? How do you entertain a bored pharaoh? You sail a boatload of young women dressed only in fishing nets down the Nile and urge the pharaoh to go catch a fish. It is almost the earliest jokes. And what I will say is I've also got sitting in front of me the oldest British joke dating back to the 10th century.
I tell you what, we'll come back to that one. Okay?
I was going to say, because for the moment, okay, you can decide in your own time. I'm not going to tell that joke on the podcast because I know we have a range of listeners and... You know,
but you know what? That one, it's not rude. It's a classic example of a double entendre. You know, there is a double meaning there, and if you don't get it, then probably a five, and it's fine. It's absolutely fine.
And one of the things I like about these, though, is all of these are slightly transgressive. That's kind of the thing I like. They are none of these ones. I mean, we're not in the world here of Gosh, I've completely lost the guy's name who did the seven words you're not allowed to say, seven words. And, you know, we're not into the realm we are today where a lot of stand-ups, a lot of comedians just tend to swear just for the sake of it to get it across the line. And because of that, these are just cheeky. This is almost sort of a historical carry-on level of humour. It's keeping sort of within the rules, but just pushing them as far as you put, you know, just pushing them that little bit further. And... I like the fact that we've got this really old gag that is about the pharaoh. It's about the pharaoh, which suggests something about the society, because comedy always does. There's a line, and I can't think who I'm quoting here for the moment. Actually, I think it's Penn Jillette, and the line is, "Our society is terrible. Our government is terrible." But it's not as bad as if we lived in a society where we couldn't say the government is terrible. And when we have all of our stand-ups making jokes about the government, and, you know, you watch any comedy show, you watch Mock the Week, you watch the news one whose name... My brain is not working at all.
Have I got news for you?
Have I Got News For You? They are mocking the government. They are really mocking... And when we have a society where jokes are being publicly made about the government... That is where comedy tells us something. It tells us that those people feel relatively safe mocking the leaders. Whereas when we move on to the Middle Ages, sort of, we have the idea of a fool, who is the person who is put in a position where he's allowed to make fun of the ruler, whereas everyone else would have been very, very careful about making certain jokes.
Yes, absolutely. But sort of going back to the sort of slight toilet humour area, I find it interesting that there was... I mean, we know about court jesters, but there seems to have been a slightly more obscure career, nowadays referred to as a medieval flatulist. And Saint Augustine, okay? So this is a very, very holy man. He, in one of his books, actually... makes reference to some of these performers, and this is an exact quote, obviously translated from Latin, which says that these performers who had, quote, such command of their bowels that they could break wind continuously at will so as produce the effect of singing. And and one of these guys was actually called Roland the Farter, and he was given, you know, we recently did a podcast about was Henry II henpecked. Whether he was or wasn't, he was regularly entertained by Roland the Farter, who was given 12 hectares, that's about 30 acres of land, in return for his services. And I like this, now this is in Latin, every year he was obliged to perform unum saltum, et sifultum et unum bumbleum, which is translated as one jump, one whistle, and one fart, which means the Latin for fart is bumbleum, which I quite like.
It is, and lest we forget, I mean, you talk about Roland there, but lest we forget, he was just the beginning of a of a long line of performers leading up in the great days of music hall and stage acts to the wonderful Le Petomane.
Yes, and, yes.
Le Petomane. Now, he preferred the term flatulist, I believe.
Which is what I said, medieval flatulist. Roland was an example of, yes.
Which is just ridiculous. I'll be completely... it's just the idea that this, you know...
It's a living, Greg.
If we had one example in history of somebody who'd made the living... And this guy would perform with a trumpet to pick up the sound and everything. It was just... yes. So... Comedy,
maybe perhaps move off this particular form of comedy. I think we've done that bit to death.
And I'm going to take us back to what you were saying, actually, about the idea of a comedy ages really, really quickly. And there are really a couple of types of comedy. There is the comedy that ages remarkably quickly, and then there's the sort of comedy that really never ages, the sort of the jokes that never age, you know, sort of. It's one of those things, people falling over in a particular manner, we've discussed this before, is funny. And that has been funny, you know, when, I don't know, Ugg the Stone Age Man was walking along and he tripped on a stone, the other people probably laughed, you know. It's something, and, you know, we see that right through history. There's that idea of physical comedy, and physical comedy actually doesn't change that much. You can refine physical comedy, you can work on it, but basically... Physical comedy, I don't think, changes an awful lot as we go through the centuries. You come up with new reasons to fall over, and you come up with new things that can accidentally hit you on the head, and you can come up with new things that you fall over, but essentially, the comedy is in that moment, and it's in the character. But when we come to spoken comedy, it's one of my biggest things about Shakespeare. And
I was going to go onto him, but I'm glad you got there first.
I thought you were going to, because it's one of the things that Upstart Crow, we've both been enjoying the Upstart Crow series, and it's one of the things that they mocked a couple of weeks ago on the series was Shakespeare's long, complicated jokes and all of this and that. And
with several layers of meaning.
Yes, several layers of meaning. And, you know, when you say several layers of meaning, it sounds really complex, but lest we forget that, you know, the latest Pixar film, every joke would have several layers of meaning, whether or not you actually get all the layers. But the crucial thing is that Shakespeare was writing for his audience, and he intended his plays to be watched by that audience in that moment and then forgotten. And so he would be making references to all sorts of things that happened in that moment. And actually, I'll tell you what I'm about to do accidentally, is I'm about to quote both Penn and Teller entirely separately. Quoted Penn a minute ago. So Teller, the silent half of the Penn and Teller, the Vegas magicians, a lot of people think he never speaks. Some people think he can't speak. But in fact, he's one of these people that he doesn't speak on stage. And when he does choose to speak off stage, he's worth listening to. He's an incredibly clever man. And he actually recently directed a version of The Tempest a couple of years ago, a really good version of Shakespeare's Tempest, and he's gone on to sort of direct other Shakespeare plays. And one of the things that I found really interesting is he said that he likes Shakespeare to be done as Shakespeare. He wants to use the Shakespeare language. Occasionally you have to modify a word or two to make most of it understandable to the audience, but, you know, Shakespeare is Shakespeare's words and all of this, and that's how he directs it. Except for comedy. And he says, when you get to the comedy in Shakespeare's plays, when he gets to that point in time, the right thing to do, the thing that really honours Shakespeare most, and I'm now paraphrasing him, I've moved on, don't let this be words in his mouth, but the right thing to do is to take Shakespeare's themes, take the ideas of that scene, take the ideas of the comedy that he's actually written down, and then translate them, not in words, but in the way that we use comedy today. You have to update the comedy. So I know in one of the plays he directed, he took a stand-up comedian, gave him the role, gave him the theme of the scenes, gave him the scenes, and then said, but now make this relevant to a modern audience. Shakespeare is supposed to be the moment. Comedy has to be of the moment. And that's one of the reasons why Shakespeare's comedies, a lot of people really don't like them, because they're not funny to a modern audience in the same way that they would have been funny to an audience in Shakespeare's time.
Yeah,
in the same way, I was only going to finish up by saying, in the same way I've mentioned Mock the Week and things, if you go back and watch an episode of Mock the Week from 2 or 3 years ago, you'll find it a lot less funny because the jokes have been and gone and passed, the people they're referring to, the things that mattered at that point in time were big political issues. At that point in time, a lot of those had gone by the wayside, and suddenly those jokes just don't hit because we don't necessarily all follow the references the same way we would have done in that particular week.
Yes, to all of the above, yes. And I would then build on it and say, in my late 20s, that's when I first met my wife, Liz. She was heavily working, in fact, she still does work in theatre. But her and her friend and several other people were all working in London theatre. And I was lucky enough to go and see a lot of theatre. Some was great, some of it wasn't. And I also went to do a lot of stand-up comedy. And what I would say is, I would argue that Shakespeare created a form of comedy unique to theatre where I just found it interesting sitting in the audience. It was such an obscure reference that a couple of people would titter to basically say, oh, I'm smart enough to get that. That's not the same thing as funny. You know, you'd get a few people going, that kind of thing. It's just a noise to prove I understood what they were going on about. You then watch a stand-up comic and people are roaring with laughter. They're almost sick with laughter. You know, your sides would ache from so much laughter. That's proper funny. And, you know, I hate this kind of put-on pretentious funniness. And as you said, you know, maybe that was the same thing as a solid stand-up comedy gag in the 1600s, but it's certainly not the way we deal with comedy nowadays. But what I wanted to do was just take things out of our traditional Western comedy and go to an area which I know a little bit about. A friend of mine...
Can I cut in just quickly before you take us out? Because you mentioned something there, comedy for theatre. And I think that this is where there's sort of... Because I think what Shakespeare created really was the idea of putting stand-up comedy in a theatre space. The way that his plays were designed was to, you know, people would go every week and they'd see the show that week and it would be lost. And so I think his is very much akin to a stand-up. And I think, again, if you watch a stand-up comedian, you know, even sort of from 30, 40, 50 years ago, a lot of their jokes don't land the same way they would have done back then because they're...
I absolutely agree with that. It's fair that they're both in the theatre. I guess what I mean is plays, not stand-up comedy, but, you know, somebody just standing there trying to make you laugh, but plays which have the occasional obscure reference to something which some people feel they need to put a forced laugh in to prove that they understood it. Not funny.
No, it's not. Whereas what I was going to say is what I think of really is theatrical comedy and the way that real theatrical comedies work, because you can watch theatrical comedies from, again, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago that are still funny all the way through. And the reason for that is the comedy is of the moment, but it's of the moment within the play as opposed to trying to set themselves in a worldwide scale. It's still the immediacy of comedy, but the difference is that, you know, for example, you go into a play and the comedy is that the characters have just ended up in this situation. You're watching the play, you're with them in that situation. And then when the comical reference comes to that particular situation, the comedy is still fresh and in the moment because you've created the moment on stage. It's as soon as you try and take comedy and reflect on it on a wider scale, I think that's when we start to fall apart. But now take us out of the Western world, Jim.
Okay, so I will take one step and then we'll get there. A friend of mine is fluent in Russian and spent years in Russia. And I just happened to be talking to him about, you know, what was it like over there, blah, blah, blah. And he was saying, you know, the very last thing you learn in a different language or a different culture is comedy. And he goes, I can read a Russian newspaper, no trouble. I can converse with a Russian, no problem whatsoever. But when I'm watching Russian comedy from its Russian roots, because it sort of depends on all these different civilizations and cultural influences, that he goes, I really don't understand it. He goes, as far as I can work out, half of it's slapstick and half it's deeply philosophical, and I can't work out where the two of them collide. So anyway, but that's a point. But then we move on to, we talked about sort of medieval comedy in Europe. Let's talk about medieval comedy in the Middle East. There is, if you were to go on holiday to modern day Turkey, you will probably find in shops occasionally a guy wearing a big sort of white turban, big smiley face, white beard, sort of very friendly, cartoony-looking character sitting on a donkey the wrong way round. So, you know, he's like facing towards the tail end of the donkey. And he's called Nasreddin Hoca. And Hojas are actually kind of religious, spiritual men. But he's a fun one. And he was a real guy as well. But, you know, when you try and translate these things, it just doesn't really work. Like, the guy says to him, why are you riding the donkey the wrong way round? And his response is, I'm the right way round. It's the donkey that's going in the wrong direction. I'm here all week. But the one that we can all get, I mean, basically they're all sort of clever plays on words or taking, misrepresenting the situation, as it were, which, you know, we have absolutely European equivalents of, like the classic, Fawlty Towers is considered an absolute classic comedy. And I think that is one that's still funny. And Basil's desperately worried about the health inspector guy, and it's actually a spoon salesman he thinks is the health inspector, and he's horrible to the health inspector guy. So, you know, it's this sort of misrepresentation of the details. But, you know, Nasreddin Hoca was a real guy, and we can all get this one. It should put a smile on your face. When he said when he died, he wanted, by his tomb, he wanted the gates to be permanently closed and to have the gates locked at all times so that nobody can get through those gates, but to not build a wall round it. Yeah, took a second.
What I like about that one is that is to my mind, that's one of the funny things. It's like radio comedy. You do have to form the picture, and again, in that instance of forming the picture, you are in that moment, and that's where the comedy comes from, I think. Again, I think what we come down to a lot is comedy is of the moment. But carry on.
So he's sort of steeped in the Turkic and Islamic area, and that's another thing. I was saying that the past is considered humorless, and then Islam is perhaps considered even more humorless because of sort of like modern, either modern fears or modern terrors, etc., etc. And it's like, no, that, you know, you, this is the thing, you go to any civilization, and if you dig hard enough, you'll find funny things. And when we get down to bodily functions, which are generally inconvenient, almost all countries have some kind of sort of fart joke. Now, they may not be steeped in political commentary and satire. That might not be a thing in, you know, ancient Mayan civilization, but everybody gets the idea, as you said, falling over at exactly the wrong moment is funny. And so I think there's always an element of slapstick in most cultures and civilizations. And then, you know, you've invariably got bodily functions considered quite funny too.
And I think, at the end of the day, it really does come down to these two things of comedy. One is, you can have comedy at the moment, comedy that works without reference. And the other thing is, comedy that works with reference. And a lot of times, it's comedy that has the specific references that are actually funny. And if I delve into my own comedy, I have learned from a long time doing my shows. I will walk on the stage and... It's one of my first rules when I do shows, and this isn't the way a lot of people do shows, but I don't know when I walk out on stage, I genuinely don't know what I'm going to do or what I'm going to say. Now, that's not the same as being an improvisational comic. I have a lot of, you know, sort of stock lines that I have in my head. I have an awful lot of, you know, props. I have standard routines that I'm going to do. And some days I go completely off script and I just do... you know, some of my stuff, and I'm making up as I go along. But most of the time when I go on, I'm using lines that I've used before. But the thing is, when I go on stage, I genuinely don't know, because I learnt a long time ago that if I go on stage with a very, very clear idea and I start talking, very often that crowd is not right for the particular bit. If you've pre-decided to do something, they might not get the references. And the epitome of this, because it triggered it when you said about another country, actually. The epitome of this is that a few years ago, and this really is what taught it to me as well, I was asked, when I was out in Italy, one of the times I was touring the school shows in Italy, I was asked by a local theatre there to take part in their English theatre festival. They basically, every weekend, they would put on an English show, a show in English, mainly aimed at sort of expats and things like that, English people who are out there, or English-speaking people. And they specifically wanted me to do the show that I had toured the year before in England, which was the origins, actually, of the Condensed Histories. It was my Condensed History of Britain show. And this seemed perfectly fine. I was like, brilliant, I've got some good pieces, I've got some funny stuff, I've got some stuff that really, really works. And I went over there, and it was probably, I don't know, 20, 30, 40 seconds into the show when I walked out there and I started to speak, and I realised that I had a series of problems, the first of which was that instead of just being the expat community, an awful lot of these people were people who knew me personally or knew me through friends or knew of me and who were Italians who had come to see my own show. Another lot of them were English speakers, but they were English speakers who were from, you know, sort of America, New Zealand, Australia, Canada, all over the world, but native English speakers. So I had half the audience who didn't understand everything I said if I said it in English, and therefore couldn't get the vocal jokes that way. The other half, when I'd written a British play about British history, I was using an awful lot of historical shorthand. I have my moment where I do my interpretive dance version of the Battle of Hastings. It's really funny if you know the basic story. It's really funny if you... I mean, to be honest, that one probably looked ridiculous enough that it was funny anyway. But the humour comes from the fact that, you know the story of the Battle of Hastings. And humour in a lot of the pieces within the show, you kind of have to have the inside knowledge of the British history. You have to have just not a massive knowledge, but a passing knowledge of British history for it to actually be at all relevant to you. And so very quickly, I realised I couldn't do my normal show. I had to kind of keep all the bits in, but I was going to have to kind of make it up as I went along and play about with it. And, you know, the show went over okay. It was fine. I got through it. I got big laughs. I got money at the end of it. I was fine. You know, this isn't a story of my lowest point in comedy. Don't worry, I've had days when I've done a bit that just didn't work whatsoever. And perhaps on another podcast, I'll talk about one of those. But this shows I'd not thought at that moment the importance that we're discovering here of things being relevant with comedy and the importance of, you know, comedy being of its time. And in that way, I think that if we do study jokes and jokes in historical context, we do learn a lot very specifically about what was actually important to people about at that time and what they would actually know about. And from that point of view, just to bring us round a little bit to history, I think that is the point at which the history of comedy and understanding comedy within history can actually tell us a great deal about the way people work. Because we've talked about
what their concerns were, what was topical for the time. Absolutely. It's kind of an unspoken area of history.
It is, but also what references they would get that aren't. One of the things I remember, we've talked about Shakespeare and having to wade through Shakespeare and try and understand it. Something sort of similar that I remember doing when I was at school were newspaper and especially Punch, I think, especially Punch cartoons, where you get given this cartoon, and I think I got one in my GCSE exams, actually. You get a cartoon and you have to explain why it's funny.
Which is really terrible. Hard.
But in order to explain sort of the joke within it, you had to know certain things. You had to know, for example, that the character, I think it's the character of John Ball, represents Britain, and he's a particular character. But he was a character that people would know. Say, like Uncle Sam is the American equivalent. You had to know that when you saw Uncle Sam meant America. And the only way you'd know that is because he was a cultural reference. And it's a, you know, and you look at all these things and you see, and from them, you can get a very good idea. Oh, right, okay, so they just put this picture in the magazine. They didn't say, by the way, John Ball in this case is a reference to England. This picture here. Oh, if you look in the background here, we've put this picture of this, this, that, the other. All of these things are little references to your daily life that you will just understand. They didn't have to say that. But when we look at one, we have to pull the whole joke apart. And then we get to understand, well, if this went out in a national newspaper and was a reference, then what this tells us straight away is they've put that in because they expect the readers to instantly look at that, get the joke and laugh. So it also tells us very clearly, right, these are the things that they expected people to all know about. They expected there to be a collective knowledge of these specific things. And in that way, I think that tells us, you know, we can know about World War One, we can know about World War Two, we can know about what was happening, but if we want to know what really seeped into the consciousness of the everyday person, if we look at the jokes, if we look at the comedy, especially the popular jokes, popular comedy, popular cartoons at the time, those can tell us something that are, you know, that reading the war articles and things can't, and that is that they can tell us what pieces of the war, what piece of news were actually being taken in by people and what references they would therefore get.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm well aware of time, so if you can give me about 90 seconds, I've got a couple of things to run by you, and then I'm done, okay? And I will keep it light. I actually dug out some actual Victorian jokes. So these are about 150 years old. I think some of these work. I think some of these don't. But, you know, let me just very quickly run through a couple of them. What is the difference between a tube and a foolish Dutchman? One is a hollow cylinder and the other is a silly Hollander.
I quite like that one.
Okay, fine. Wife, you loved me before we were married. Husband, well, now it's your turn. So you get it. You understand what the point of reference is. But here's an example of one where it's clearly lost in the mist of time. It's clearly using slang that doesn't work anymore. Why are circus horses the slowest breed? Because they are taut horses. Whatever. So my final point is, I always like these two lines. One, if you have to explain a joke, it's not funny. And secondly, comedy is the only thing that if you do it badly, people don't laugh.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. Yeah.
Yeah, so there we go. Those are my sage moments. Shall we go to the wrap-up and the promotions and things like
well,
that?
Well, as you've made the comment about, you know, you've made that nice little line about comedy being the only thing that don't laugh. It's one of those things that I always try and explain to people because it's one of those weird things historically that when we look at theatre and drama and everything else, comedy always seems to be the poor cousin of, as it were, legitimate theatre, you know.
Yes.
The play, the dramatic play is something to be held up, whereas the comedian, and yet it's amazing to me, and I may be biased here because I'm a comedy performer, but in that same way, comedy is so much harder than drama to write and perform and everything else, because especially in this country, if you write drama and it doesn't work, the audience sit there politely and listen. If you write drama and it does work, the audience sit there politely and listen. If you write comedy and it doesn't work, the audience generally sit there politely and listen. If you write comedy and it does work, they laugh.
I'm going to say a lot of people don't politely sit there and listen if it's not funny. They'll tell you.
Oh, yes. No, now don't get me wrong. We have hecklers and everything else. But generally speaking, if it's a comedy play, you know, people watch the play. But yeah, it's this incredible thing that, you know, the drama has. But if you get comedy wrong, everybody knows it. If you get drama wrong, you can be watching a drama play and think, am I the only one that thinks this is a bit rubbish? So anyway, with that little thought in mind, I think, Jem, we've got to wrap up very, very quickly. So one of the funniest books that I've read this year by a long shot. That doesn't really work. My feed line doesn't work. So just you promote your own
Yeah, so Silent Crossroads, it's not particularly funny, although some people like the banter of the soldiers. I try and keep it real. You know, do you know what? I don't like it when dramas are just endlessly depressing and full on. There are lighter, absolutely light moments, silly moments in the book, but it's certainly not a comedy. But if you want a sort of wartime drama, Silent Crossroads, still available out there. Kindle, please have a look.
And from my point of view, just go to condensedhistories.com. And you'll find the condensedhistories.com gems page, all about the History Gems podcast. You'll find out all about my shows and everything else going on there. So just head over there. And most importantly, thank you all so much for listening. I've said it every week for the last few weeks, but we are going up in numbers. And so please, if you're listening to this, do me a favour once again this week. Go and find someone you haven't told about the podcast yet. Just go over to them and just say to them, great podcast, give it a listen. I'll tell you what, actually, just don't even bother with that. Just find someone that's got an iPhone, borrow their iPhone for a minute, and just subscribe them to the podcast. They can find it later and have a listen that way. I'm not sure that's entirely legal, so don't do it if it's not. But thank you all for listening. Thank you so much to my wonderful co-host, Mr. Jem Deducci.
And to my wonderful and funny co-host, Greg Chapman.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And that's all from us this week. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye, and take care.